All right. My name is Yo Azama. I'm 51 years old. Today is November 23rd, 2020, and I'm speaking with Ann Jordan, who is my friend and mentor. I'm recording this interview in my house in Marina, California.
My name is Ann Jordan, and I'm 64 years old. Today is November 23rd, 2020, and I'm speaking with Yo Azama, who is my very good friend and colleague, and I am recording this interview in San Jose, California, in my home.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today. And today I'd like to ask you and about your mother, Tay Diggs, who has passed away recently at the age of 97. And I know she started the first Japanese program in Salinas Union High School District in Salinas back in the 80s. But before I ask you more about that, first I'd like to ask you, could you tell me why and how your mother moved to the US from Japan in the 50s, if I remember correctly?
Well, let's see. In order to tell that, I have to go back a little ways before 50s, because, you know, what was the motivation? You know, what was the interest in America? And it started for her, I think, she used to say, she was really influenced by her aunt, Sumi. And Aunt Sumi was, you know, she never married. She was a spinster aunt. And Aunt Sumi lived in Kobe. And my mom met her for the first time when she was five. And she took a train down from Tokyo to Kobe. And at the time, Suma no Obachan, she lived in the Suma area of Kobe. Aunt Sumi, she was an English teacher at a school called Kobe Jogakuin High School. So if you think about that, that was the late 1920s.
Oh my God.
So to be a woman, young woman teaching English, you know, at that time, which was less than, you know, about 50 years after Japan even had opened up, right?
To the right, US.
I mean, it was really a long time ago. So at the time, my Aunt Sumi was living in a big Western style house with the German consulate officer and his wife. And so for my mom at the age of five to be in this Western style house, big Western style house, it was the first time for her to sit at a table, use silverware instead of hashi, chopsticks, eat different kind of food, German food, you know.
Schnitzels.
Totally. And it was so strange, yet wonderful. So this made a huge impression on my mother. And then she, throughout her, you know, elementary years in high school, was always interested in, for, you know, further, more, even more interested in Western culture and English. And she attended, some of her schools that she attended were run by American missionaries. So she always had just a really strong affinity and a really good feeling, you know. And also my grandfather was pro-democracy. You know, and so she remembers sitting around my grandfather, Tsutomu Yajima, and they were very excited about, you know, about the democracy movement in Japan. And people used to come and to the house, and she remembers all these discussions, you know, political discussions. So it was a very hopeful time, I think. And then, of course, Japan changed little by little. My mom described, you know, she used to talk, she said, well, the discussions became quieter and quieter as the right-wing nationalist movement, you know, in Japan became stronger. And then there's something called the Kenpeitai, which is like the secret police, I guess,
who
you know, get your neighbors to tell on your other neighbors. So she said pretty soon all those kinds of discussions at her house stopped because people were in fear. So in 1940, My mom, however, was still really interested in America and Western culture, and she wanted to go to the university and major in English. And actually, my grandfather, some of the relatives were not in favor of that because, as a woman, why are you going to waste your time going to a four-year university to study that? What a waste! You should go to Hanayome Gakko, like all good, you know, wives to be.
And
My grandfather, you know, was a big supporter in women and everybody getting an education. Huh. And in fact, you know, one of the things that she often told, you know, a story about my grandfather saying, you know, it's really important for women, especially to have a higher education, so that in case something happens to their husband, so it was still linked, you know, to the husband. But in case
practical reason.
In case something happens to the husband, then you have a professional skill that you can rely on, you know. Hmm. And my mom said often, you know, that he often said, we don't really have money. We can't leave you with an inheritance, you know, my mother and her two brothers. Mm-hmm. But we can provide you with an education, and no matter what happens, nothing can take that away. And one of the many gifts that my mother left us was all the letters and writings and, you know, notes that she had. And as I go through these, recently I saw something that she wrote regarding that. She said, you know, when my father said that, it really, really became, I really understood what he meant, that when their house during the war completely burned to the ground, they lost everything, but the education that she received remained. And so what got her to the United States was after the war, well, during the war, her school also burned completely to the ground. School was ended anyways, like in 3 years, they said, you're graduated, you know, everybody, school's over. This was still wartime, and she went to teach. Her first job was in Ibaraki Prefecture as an English teacher at a high school, girls' high school. She loved it. I've seen pictures, you know, recently of we all remember our first class, right? Yeah. The first class that we ever taught. So I knew, I know that feeling that she has. And she wrote in her memoir something like, I can remember every kid's name. And, you know, we can't remember last year's students sometimes. But we remember that first class.
The first, that's right. You know, remember.
But maybe it's because we were younger. I don't know. But but after the war ended, now her English skills were an asset, you know, her training, her professional training. Right. So she worked for a few years for the counterintelligence corps of the U.S. Military occupation forces. And some few years later, she answered an ad for a Japanese culture teacher teaching at Narimas Elementary School in Tokyo at a school for the American children of the American military stationed, you know, now in Japan. So this was so I think she started working there around 1950 at Narimas Elementary School. That was the turning point, because she was working alongside American teachers. She had all these wonderful, you know, mentors and people who she was so inspired by. And she said, she wanted to come study in the United States, but it seemed like, I mean, that was a crazy dream, you know, and also the Aunt Sumi, who had been her influence, she had had the opportunity to study in the United States in the 19, as a young woman. She won a essay contest sponsored by an American publishing house. She could not go because she was a woman and because it was crazy, you know, to go in the early 20s. So Aunt Sumi really supported that too. But my grandparents didn't have funds. It was crazy idea. But those teachers really, they held fundraisers, they held bingo games, they did all the, just not even the, not just the teachers, the parents at the school. The principal at the school became her visa sponsor. While the PTA president was from Oklahoma and suggested that my mother, Tay, apply to Oklahoma College for Women, because the United States was just a big monolithic blob to my mom. It did, you know, Oklahoma. So she did, and she was accepted. And what was attractive about that, especially, was that the Oklahoma College for Women said that if she would work in the dining room at the college, university dining room, they would cover, she wouldn't have to pay room and board, and she wouldn't have to pay out of state fees. So, So she was accepted, and that's, you know, and the teachers raised money to help her pay her way, you know, on the ship. They gathered their own clothes to put a wardrobe together for her to take to the States, you know, all of these things happened. And so, you know, that's what led her to go to the US. Yes. But the goal, her objective was to just stay 1 year, study, come back to Japan, and take what she learned here. And, you know, and in fact, I found recently the I found her original letter, the draft of her scholarship application that she wrote to Oklahoma College for Women, because she applied also for financial aid scholarship there. And the last paragraph, she said, "More than anything else, I wish to go to the United States to experience the feeling of freedom and happiness, to become acquainted with young students and professors, to learn as much as possible, and to reach a full understanding of American democracy by living with it. After returning to Japan, I will use my experience gained to teach the next generation of Japan a new and brighter way of life." Well, she didn't go back to Japan because she met my father. I mean, she didn't go back to Japan after a year, you know.
It took
a few more years, but she, you know, things change. She met my dad, and she stayed in Oklahoma, continued on to study and get a master's at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. And then I was born in Norman in 1956. And my father's plan was to go, then he had been in Asia, in Korea, and was an Asian studies major, and he wanted to get a master's at the University of Washington in Seattle. But I was born, and you know, that costs money. So he rejoined the military, but that's what brought them to Monterey, because my father was then assigned to Monterey, to the Defense Language Institute.
Defense Language Institute.
To study Korean. So, you know, that's how we ended up in Monterey County in 1959. You know.
That's wonderful. And then this whole thing, you know, her traveling to the U.S., you know, in the 50s, right? So I imagine she had to take a ship and a train to get to Oklahoma from California. And I'm imagining, you know, she traveled by herself, or, you know, how did she do that, you know?
She did
travel by herself. Oh my god,
she did. So so first of all, she was on a freighter, so it wasn't a fancy cruise ship. It was a freighter ship. She was the only woman. And it was called the Nikkei Maru, I think, and it was sailed in July of 1953. And I also found her diary that she started, that she wrote, kept from 1953 to 55. And it's in English. Some parts are in English, some parts are in Japanese, but it includes at the time that she was on the ship. So that was really interesting. She was the only woman. So I think she was a young, you know, young woman. She was close to 30. And she described, you know, the passengers were, it was just her. And there was, I think, a couple of other passengers, and the rest was all crew. She arrived in Long Beach, California, the port of Long Beach.
Right.
And then took the Southern Pacific Railroad from Long Beach to somewhere in Oklahoma. And, you know, and when she arrived in Oklahoma, another teacher who, this was summertime. So at that time, if you were a Department of Defense teacher, you could, I think every couple of years you can return for a vacation to your, to the U.S. And then, so it was summertime, and there was one of the teachers at Narimas Elementary was from Oklahoma, and met her at the train station and, you know, helped her to get situated.
Wow. What a journey. I mean, I can only imagine a woman her age in 20s, right? And take that kind of trip. Mm-hmm. To overseas, and then once there was an enemy's country, mm-hmm. by herself, and you know, with this curiosity and this thirst for like freedom and democracy. I mean, as you described, you know, what a courageous woman. And and also, I noticed you mentioned there was a teacher that she had teachers who guided her, mm-hmm. you know, supported her in this journey, and she was a teacher, and so were you. You're a teacher too. So I'm wondering, how did your mother influence you as a teacher?
Well, for starters, I never, you know, some people, when you say, "Oh, what made you become a teacher," or you know, whatever profession, and some people say, "I always wanted to be this." Well, I never wanted to be a teacher. At least, I'm not saying that I was opposed to it, but it wasn't something that I was looking. I always thought I was destined for more glamorous.
Hollywood.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to be an artist, and then I wanted to be a writer, you know, journalism. But a teacher, especially, you know, a high school teacher, never ever pictured myself as that. However, I always saw, you know, my mom. These days, everybody, you know, a lot of people have home office, you know, and or especially now with, you know, everything being remote, you know, virtual teaching and all that, you know, teachers have a really nice, like, you know, they got to set up a little home office. Yeah. There was no such thing, you know, when I was growing up, the kitchen table. And there was maybe, you know, when I was in high school, then my mom actually had a desk, but it was in the same room that my brother and I watched television. So I spent 4 or 5 years. I spent my high school years, at least when I was home, seeing every night my mother's back, because and her back was like hunched over the desk till pretty late. What was she doing? She was doing teacher work. So, I mean, that didn't really look that attractive, honestly.
That's a lot of work. Yeah,
that's a lot of work. But she really, now that I think of, you know, at the time, I didn't reflect on that. But when I'm doing that, I'm retired now, but I was almost always the last person in my building to leave, you know, what was I doing? Nobody was looking at my back, but there I was, she was, you know, it was. So I think she modeled that work ethic, you know, but she also, it gave her a lot of satisfaction and joy. Yeah. And, so even though that wasn't something that I thought I would do, I actually, that my first job was a type of teacher, because when I was in high school, I was mm-hmm. tutoring kids, going out to the farms, the flower growers' trailers mm-hmm. outside of Salinas, and tutoring after school, helping. Mm-hmm. I helped in my mom's classroom when I was a student in Japan. Well, what kind of job? What is the typical job that a American student in Japan gets? A kaiwa no sensei, right? So I was teaching, and I liked it, and I felt at that time like I think I'm good at this. So it in that way, yeah, you know. And of course, she encouraged me.
She did,
to do that. But again, it's kind of funny. She thought it was a really good job for me, probably because maybe she saw that I had a talent for it, and maybe partly mm-hmm. because she liked that it was what she did. And then mm-hmm. also she said, if you're a teacher, you can raise a family and teach because you have, summers off or this and that. And I thought, well, that's right. a stupid reason to be a teacher. But actually, it's kind of a good reason.
right.
But that's not, it can't be the only reason.
No, it cannot be.
Yeah. What she never said was because you'll make a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah, that was never.
So you kind of already mentioned this, but like, do you have moments that you see her in yourself? Would you describe those moments?
There are moments when I see a reflection of myself, in the mirror or in a window, and I kind of go like, oh my gosh, is that, or that's my mom, mm-hmm. But as far as behavior, so looks, or if I hear like my parents' voices are, they remain, because mm-hmm. my father was in, he did several tours of duty as a military officer away from us, for like a year in Vietnam, 1 year in Korea, another year in Korea. So during that time, there were letters, but as the technology developed, we also have reel-to-reel tapes. So we would recorded message, and then my dad would record back. And then a little bit later, the technology got even better, and it was cassette, mm-hmm. Cassette tapes. So that was also a gift. So when I listen to those tapes, and if I hear my mom's voice, it's a little bit disconcerting, because it mm-hmm. sounds like we sound similar, mm-hmm. our voices are very similar. Mm-hmm. When I feel it a lot, it's when I'm in the kitchen, and that's not a lot. My husband does a lot of, he's like the main chef in our house. He's really good at it. But I'm in charge of the Japanese food. So that's my domain. A few weeks ago, I was making, what is it in English? Like cutlet, right? Fried cutlet, katsu. And I don't do that too often, because it makes a big mess, because you're frying and it's not healthy, right? But the kids love it. And so for my daughter's birthday, mm-hmm. we were having dinner outside, of course, because it's a pandemic. But if you're going to make fry, that much katsu, you might as well fry if you're going to fry katsu, you might as well fry a bunch. So when I was standing over the hot oil with the long chopsticks, I felt like I was she was in my body,
Oh, wow.
Because those are the time, I her at the kitchen in front of the uh-huh. stove, and uh-huh. her at the desk hunched uh-huh. over her schoolwork is very, uh-huh. yeah.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you to have, mother, momentarily, like you became your mom, that feeling that you described, what was it like?
It was, since she, her passing is so recent, it was weird. It was kind of, I didn't feel sad. I felt kind of peaceful. I felt like, ah, this is, she's, you know, with me. And because it's a pandemic, you know, kids, my daughter couldn't come inside the house, but I had the window to the kitchen window open. And so Allison was looking through the window, watching me cook. And she's like, oh, it makes me think of grandma, you know? And so it was a sweet moment, actually.
Speaking of food, I remember she's a great, you know, cook. And she would often invite us to New Year's get together, usually like a January 3rd or 4th or something like that. And she had osechi, traditional Japanese food. I still remember mame, omame. Mm-hmm. And she would make it everything from scratch.
Right.
And we have fun, great time. And then she will always give me food to go. Here, take it, you know. So what are like some of her dishes you miss the most?
Well, osechi for sure, because, you know, we only get that once a year. And as you said, she didn't buy, you know, now you really, I mean, I have to put quotation marks around, I make osechi. No, like a lot of people these days, why I don't need to, I can just go to the Japanese supermarket and it's right there, you know, already made. Even if that was available, you know, my mom made it from scratch because at the time it wasn't available. You had to make it yourself. But even if it's available, two reasons she wouldn't buy it like that. One, it's too expensive, right?
I can make it. I can make it better. Yeah,
that's right. And that's the other thing. And also she really enjoyed that process. I think it was really satisfying for her. You know, if she sits if everybody sits around, like, you know, people coming over, it gave her so much satisfaction and joy, you know, to have people eat that. Well, if she hadn't made it herself, then she's just, you know, then they're just enjoying what somebody else made and that she assembled. And, you know, it wasn't the same. So I think I will miss that because, unfortunately, I didn't pay enough attention really when I was able to, you know, because she hadn't been able to do that for many years due to, you know, a lot of different reasons, one being dementia.
Sure.
So I didn't learn how to do it when I had the chance because I thought, oh, I'm too busy or I have time. I can do it later. Well, you know, we didn't get later. So, so that's a lesson, but that, and then just, gyoza.
I knew you were going to say it.
Because she would make so much gyoza that it was, you know, I can picture the entire table covered with gyoza and then a lot of it then went into the freezer, but, or she packaged it up and then gave it to us to take home, you know, put in our freezer and cook later. So
yeah definitely gyoza and a mame, those two things that come out of my mind.
She really liked kuro mame, the black
beans. she did
and kobumaki.
Kobumaki
from scratch. It was pretty amazing.
So good. Yeah, I remember that. So, you know, I think I told you this before. If I were to describe your mom in one word, just the first word that comes up my mind is like grace. She's so gracious, like effortlessly, without trying. She is a graceful person. She has the grace, you know. And now learning about her journey to America and courage and curiosity and this sense of kind of determination, the strong core, which I see in you too. Now, is there anything, what is one thing that might surprise us about your mother that we don't know about, if you could share?
Well, there's one thing that surprised me and I didn't know about until I was an adult, maybe in my early 20s. But that thing that I, and I'll share that in a moment, but I think that that's the context, because you talk about Grace. She also, as you know, was always really positive and optimistic, even though there's so much, there was a lot of dark disappointment in her life. And so it could have been, it could have gone, you know, she could have easily been a very pessimistic, negative person. And yet, you know, she wasn't. So part of what made her come to the United States, or give her, I guess, the courage to come to the United States, is I think if you don't have anything to lose, you may have more, you know, I don't know if the word is easier, but you may take a risk more. And definitely in 1953, as a, you know, doing what she did, that was risky. But the reason to take that risk is because what was behind her, a door in her mind had already, a really big door had already closed. And what that is as I did not know until I was in my 20s that my mother had been married before. And during the war, when after my mother was teaching at the English school in Ibaragi Prefecture, her mother, my grandmother, the war was getting, you know, it was getting scarier and scarier. And so my grandmother said, Teiko-chan, I want you to come back to Tokyo. You know, we need to be able to evacuate at that time my grandfather was working in Shanghai too. So I think she just wanted her kids closer. So my mom came back and she got a job working for the International Red Cross. Because her English skills, they wanted somebody who could screen the letters of the American POWs, which actually is not, I think that's a violation of the Geneva Convention. I'm not sure. But, you know, so the letters that the prisoners of war were sending to their families, and that their families were sending before they went to their destination, they had people like my mother, who could read and understand English, reading them to see if there was anything, you know. Her supervisor in that job, or the head of the Red Cross, was a man named Yamamoto, who had a son who was in the army, Japanese military. He was an officer. This was a military family. And so he said, you know, you should meet my son, you know. It was an arranged marriage. And it was a very unhappy marriage. And about 2 days, 2 or 3 days before one of the major firebombings of Tokyo, and in fact, the one that destroyed my grandparents' house, my mom was basically told, you know, this isn't working out, so go back to your home, you know, which was, she was being released from the marriage. So in a weird way, you know, so I mean, that was the choice was stay in an unhappy marriage,
right,
or not be in an unhappy marriage, but be stigmatized, because it was a stigma, you know. It was very shameful. And so she, you know, pulled her belongings and put all of her belongings that she had taken, and her father-in-law pulled the cart, and she pushed the cart, because they had to walk from Koenji to where my mother's family lived in Ikebukuro. And, you know, so that was very dark. It was like leaving in shame. Then their house was completely destroyed a couple of days later. And she talks about that was like the darkest time I had, you know, so you could easily lose hope. But because of that, or in spite of that, she's always been always like glass half full, not glass half empty. So you look at the same situation. So that made it possible for her, because she knew she was going back to Japan after 1 year, and she would dedicate her life to education because nobody would marry her. She was damaged goods. And then look, you know, she had a completely different life than she had even, you know, ever, you know, imagined. I can't really remember what your question was.
Precious, it's one thing that surprised us about your mother. I did not know about that dark history. I mean, I knew that the war was happening, you know, it was, you know, going through that phase in the society, a whole society was in a dark time, and but she was able to maintain hope during that time, stay, remain positive. What would you ask your mother if she were here today?
You know, like I mentioned earlier, she left the gift of, well, not just her life, but so much detail, you know, and we moved around a lot. We moved during the period from about 1959 to 71, when we finally sort of settled in Salinas. We were vagabonds, you know, going from military base to military base, you know, in the US and in Japan. And so I have no idea how these documents, you know, did they move them from place to place? I don't know, you know. I would like to ask her, Mom, whenever we moved, did you take all these letters and then take them back, or did you store them, leave them in storage here? You know, but I'm really grateful for that, because they left such it paints a picture of not just her history, but it paints a picture for me, you know, because what their life, her life was like, what she was thinking, also in the day-to-day, the daily letters that she wrote to my father, to my dad, when he was in Vietnam and in Korea, of course, who is the topic of converse of the letter a lot of times? The children.
Children,
right? You. So I'm like, oh, that's right. You know, so things that either I had forgotten or they weren't in my conscious memory, they're in there. And they're there for her grandchildren, you know? So, there isn't a lot that I would have to ask her, because she left a lot. It might just be, you know, things that are mentioned. For example, in her diary, before she meets my dad, there's some guy, she talks about Jack. Jack came over.
Jack?
And my dad's name is Hayes, not Jack. You know, so like, today Jack and I did this. I'm like, who the heck is Jack? I sure wish I would love to know that, because this is the first that I'm hearing about Jack.
It's kind of as a child to see, you know, we tend to see our parents as parents, but they were human. They were their life before, you know, they became parents too. So it's kind of,
I would also like, I also would like to ask her how to make the kuromame, you know, the way that
she yes, that's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah, we have about a minute or so. And I just want to thank you and for taking the time and sharing your story and your mom's story with us, and I kind of hope that this interview will benefit all the students and teachers you know, in Salinas, from the past and then present and the future to come, so that, you know, it's important for us to know what came before us and what we are leaving behind.
Thank you for the opportunity. I also, there may need to be a second one just for the evolution of the Japanese program in Salinas, because I'm sorry we didn't get to.
No, let's do it again. Oh, yeah. Let's do it again. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right.